The Gopher Legislative Advisory Board was created by Executive Order 2020-06. That order is publicly available on the governor's website. Today's meeting is an official meeting of the board, is open to the public, and will be run in a manner compliant with New Hampshire RSA 91-A. We have someone on the phone taking minutes, which will be posted to the Gopher webpage. Today's meeting is also being recorded. Should you be a speaking participant and not wish to be recorded, you may disconnect now. My name is Jerry Little. I am Director of the Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery, and I will be facilitating today's meeting. Because the board is meeting by phone, under RSA 91-A, there are a few initial logistics that we need to establish. First, each of us must state our names, where we are located, and who is with us in the room, and we'll do that through this roll call. I am Jerry Little, Director of the Gopher, in Gopher offices at One Eagle Square in Concord, and with me in the room are Rhonda Hensley and Kate Spiner. Senate President Donna Soucy.
Donna Soucy here. I am at my home in Manchester, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Thank you, Senator. Speaker Steve Shurtleff.
Steve Shurtleff, I'm at my residence in Penacook, New Hampshire, and I am alone.
Senate Leader Chuck Morse.
I am here. I'm in my office in Atkinson, New Hampshire, and I'm alone.
House Leader Dick Hinch.
Dick Hinch is here. I'm in my office in Merrimack, and I am alone.
Chairman Lou D'Alessandro.
By myself.
Chairwoman Mary Jane Wallner.
This is Mary Jane Wallner. I'm from Hampshire, and I'm by myself.
Senator John Reagan.
John Reagan in my home office.
Representative Aaron Hennessy.
Aaron Hennessy, I'm at my home in Littleton, and my two minor children are in the house with me.
Thank you, everyone. As we move through our agenda today, each board member and anyone else speaking is asked to identify themselves before speaking. Should you choose to take any votes today, they must be done by the roll call following the process we just used. And finally, before we begin today's presentations, please remember to use 5-star if you would like to ask a question. Also, presenters are asked to hit 5-star when their turn comes up, as that allows us to unmute your line. Are there any questions before we begin today's scheduled presentations? Seeing and hearing
Jerry?
None. Yes, sir.
Jerry?
Yes.
It's Senator Chuck Morse. I actually hit 5-star. I'm not sure what happened. At the end of the last presentation from DIA, there are several requests for future presentations and then a few other requests for other things. So if we could just put that on the agenda, it would be great.
Very good. We will we'll be sure to discuss future meetings and presentations at the end of this agenda. Today's presentations are focused on the hospitality industry and the New Hampshire business community. Our speakers today are going to be in this order, and they will have other presenters with them. Mike Summers from the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association, Nancy Kyle from the New Hampshire Retail Association, Gary Abbott from New Hampshire General Contractors, Peter McNamara from New Hampshire Auto Dealers Association, and Jim Roach, President of the Business and Industry Association. Mike Summers, if you are with us, we'd like to start your presentation now, please. And could you tell us who you might have with you?
Yes. Can you hear me?
Yes, we can. Thank you.
All right. So for the record, Mike Summers, New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association. I'm in my office in Concord, and I am alone. What I'd like to do is I'll introduce my guest speakers that are with me. I'd like to make a brief opening statement and then turn it over to them. My guests today are Tom Boucher from Great New Hampshire Restaurants, who will give an overview of a restaurant perspective and how it's affecting his business. I'm going to turn it over, then give it to Steve Dupree of Dupree Hospitality, who will talk about the hotel side of the industry. And then I'm going to invite Sim Willey from Hart's Turkey Farm in Meredith to offer some remarks, as a big part of his business is focused against catering and function business, and I think he has some data to share with you as well. But let me start with an overview of where the industry is right now and kind of the size and impact of the COVID-19 response has been. You know, a rough estimate of the losses for the industry, if you take half of March, April, and May, are somewhere in the neighborhood of about $800 million. And that is going to be reflected, in the significant drop in rooms and meals taxes. I was able to get some preliminary data from Department of Revenue yesterday, and at this point, it looks like the state revenues are going to be down about $11.8 million for the last 2 weeks in March, or 43%. There is some discussion around restaurants still being open for takeout and delivery. About half of our restaurants have elected to do that. The other half of us have elected to close, and of the ones that are doing it, there is probably about half of them will likely give up on the takeout and delivery model some point in the next 30 days. I will also share with you that I hear regularly that businesses are closing. Heard another one this morning, and I know of at least four or five just in the Portsmouth area that have closed permanently. There was some survey data that we were able to collect. Of that survey data, 93% of our businesses have laid off staff, with another 6% of them going to take additional layoffs or lay off people if they've been ultimately trying to carry them through this issue. We're waiting on ELMI data, which we expect will be later this work. I had a conversation with Rich Lavers, and I hope to get some hard data from him, but our best guess and estimates for the organization is somewhere in the neighborhood of 40 to 50,000 people have likely been laid off in the hospitality and tourism sector. I will share with you, I've listened in on this committee's discussions, the first few meetings. There has been some discussion around, what are the things that businesses can access for help to weather this so that, we can spread the $1.25 billion as far as we can. I know that the Paycheck Protection Program came out, ran out of money in a very short period of time. But the one thing I want to share with you is from the statistics that I saw today from the National Restaurant Association, only 8.9% of the money and the funds went to the hospitality industry, hospitality food service industry. In closing, I would like to just share with you that this has legitimately been catastrophic for our industry. We, as an industry, are going to need significant support as part of this program. We suspect it will be in the hundreds of millions of dollars that will be needed just to prop businesses up. This does not make them whole by any measure. It will simply allow them to get through this and be able to come out the other side and begin to open their businesses and raise rooms and meals tax for the state. And the last thing I will add is one of the things we are going to need from the state, and we've already had cursory discussions with Division of Travel and Tourism, is we are going to need a great deal of support from the state focused around marketing and promotion as we hopefully ease into some new normal where we can open, at least in some capacity, because without that marketing, convincing consumers that, restaurants will be safe to dine in, hotels are safe to stay in, it could get very ugly and be very long. So I'm going to leave it there, and I'm going to ask Tom Boucher to weigh in.
Great. Thank you. Can you all hear me?
Yes. Yes, sir.
Okay. Yeah, so Tom Boucher, I'm at our home office here in Bedford, New Hampshire, and I'm in a private office alone. So I hope all of you received the documents that Mike shared with the committee. And what I'd like to do is just walk you through each of these so you understand what I'm going to share. What I'm sharing is our real financial numbers. It's a risk that I'm taking because I know this is public record, but I didn't want to share anecdotal numbers. I wanted to get real numbers. I worked very hard with our accounting office to prepare these financials for you and to try and present them in a very simple manner. So the very first document I want you to look at is a JPEG that shows a graph of our sales for 6 weeks, March 10th through April 14th. And the graph is showing year-over-year numbers. And when you look at that, the very first week was the week when, before the COVID-19 order came down. The second week was when COVID-19 just started to really hit the media and people started to take precautions from going out. So we were down about 20% that week. The following week, the third week, is when Governor Sununu issued the order to close all in-house dining on starting on St. Patrick's Day. And as you can see, we've maintained that level of being off approximately 81% in revenue year over year. I'm told by Mike Summers that we're actually faring a little bit better than a lot of operators. I'm hearing some operators are down 85 to 90%. The next document is the one that's labeled 50%, and the password to open that is 4647. And before I continue, I just want to make sure everybody has that document.
Yes.
Yes.
Okay, great. So what this is showing, the black column on the left is showing our real actual numbers for the five T-bones and one CJs for last year's 2019 entire year. I did not include the two copper doors because they're kind of an anomaly in the industry and in this state. They're more of a higher-end, big city feel, and it's not the typical restaurant that you would find in New Hampshire. And I didn't want to misrepresent what the entire industry is feeling. And T-Bones and CJ's are certainly very representative of full-service restaurants in New Hampshire. So going down...
If I could, I don't have those documents. So all of them in writing, but I don't have them.
I'm going to defer to Mike Summers because I'm pretty sure he sent them around.
And sorry, this is Erin Hennessy. I had my hand raised. I don't have those documents either.
And this is Dick Hinch. Nor do I.
If you give us a second, we'll move forward.
I don't have them either.
Yeah, Steve Sherrill looked likewise.
Give us a minute. We'll resend the documents. So can you continue, Tom, for the moment while we resend the documents?
Sure. So I will start to review the last year's actual numbers again for the five T-bones and one CJ's. I broke it down by expense departments. So you'll see labor expense, food cost expense, beverage expense, benefits. And I won't list all the categories because in a moment you'll see them. But as you get to the very bottom, our total expenses for the year were $26,955,000. Our revenues were, our food revenue was just shy of $22 million. Our beverage revenue, which is beer, wine, and spirits, was a little less than $7 million, for a total revenue of $28,786,000. Our net EBITDA was $1,008,000, which is a return on sales of 6.4%. And the reason I'm sharing that with you is because the industry average is somewhere between 4 and 5%. So we're a little bit better than that, but that just gives you an idea of how narrow the margins are in our industry. And I should mention, we've been open for 35 years, and this is a very typical year for us, just looking at those numbers. When you include CapEx, which are things that restaurants routinely have to replace, like air conditioners and refrigerators and carpets, our unlevered free cash flow is $1.5 million. Should I continue?
Yes, please.
Okay. The next column is the orange column, and that shows the first 2 weeks of this epidemic shutdown. And if you go all the way to the bottom, you'll see that we lost $140,000 a week. So that's our burn rate right now. We're going through $140,000 a week of our operating bank accounts just to stay open with takeout and curbside. The next page, you've got a blue column and a red column. What I modeled out there was, and I've heard this being mentioned in other states, and I'm imploring you not to take a look at this as a solution. And I know this isn't this committee's decision, but a 50% volume or reduction in certificate of occupancy would be disastrous. It would be worse than what it is right now. If that existed over 6 months, we would lose $3.8 million. If it existed in the red column for 3 months, we would lose almost $2 million. The next page, and I did this just because I've heard, again, from other state officials, because I am a member of the National Restaurant Association, so I do speak with many colleagues around the country. There have been some legislators around the country that are suggesting that a 50% reduction in capacity in the restaurants so you can have good spacing would cut every expense by 50%, which is absolutely not true. You still would have full rent to pay. You would still have full health care to pay.
How is
Sarah? You would still have workers' comp and liability insurance.
Excuse me.
All
excuse me. Somebody has their phone open. Would you please mute? We're hearing a background conversation.
That's
Thank
good.
You.
I love you.
Are you still able to hear me? Are you still able to hear me?
Yes.
Okay.
Yes, we can hear you, Tom, and I'd just like to confirm that people have received the resent documents. They're titled Gopher Restaurant Documents, and the email would come from Rhonda. Sorry for the interruption, Tom. Please go ahead.
Okay. All right, so as I was saying, the purple column was an exercise that I did because I've been hearing from colleagues around the country that some state legislators are considering running a 50% model in the restaurants, and their reasoning is that they thought that expenses would be reduced by 50% if you only had 50% of the volume, and that, of course, is just absolutely not true. You would still have to pay your rent in full. You'd still have to pay your health insurance in full, your liability insurance, your workers' comp. It's just a tremendous amount of false thinking that our expenses would be reduced by 50%. Even if that was true, which it's not going to be, we would still lose $1 million over 3 months. So I just wanted to put that out there that we have to be reopened in a manner that allows us to at least break even, not lose even more money than we're losing right now. The next document is called New York Times. It's just a Word document. And it's an article that was in New York Times about a week ago, so this is a week old information. But what I wanted to point out was the graph and the survey at the very bottom. They surveyed 6,000 businesses, restaurants, and they served small businesses and restaurants. And if you look at the restaurants and bars middle row, this shows the likelihood of the 6,000 businesses that say that they're going to be able to stay open for 1 month, 72% only. So that's 28% that would be gone 3 weeks from now, because, again, this is a one-week-old information. If it's 4 months, we would lose 70% of the restaurants in this country. It's just unfathomable and unthinkable. The last document, is something that, as I put in my statement that should have been emailed to you as well, to just be on record of what we're looking at. This is my idea that we discussed at the New Hampshire Lodging and Restaurant Association board meeting just this morning, for what we think your committee can help us with the $1.25 billion. These are all expenses that the PPP money does not cover. And I'm not going to go into what PPP covers because I'm sure you all know. But what we're looking to do is these are actual expenses for our 8 restaurants and our meat suites and catering for March, April, May, and June. So I broke it down by insurance being almost $67,000. These are actual expenses for those 4 months. Auto liability, life disability, the principal and loans because the interest is covered by PPP. And then some of these others are ones that we pay for, some the landlord pays for, but I just culled out the ones that we have to pay for. And then, of course, when we do restart back up, our walk-ins and our dry storage are, you know, 80% empty because we're not doing the volume. So we need income to be able to start restocking our kitchens. So those are listed out there. So when you add all that up, it comes out to $929,859. So what does that mean? It means that's the amount that we would be looking from this committee, from the fund, to help support what PPP doesn't support. And the way that we modeled it out, and as I said in my statement that I emailed, we're coming here to offer a solution. I didn't want to just come here with a handout saying, this is how much we need. Here's the idea that we had. The meals and rentals tax that's collected for the entire year of 2019 was $360 million. And the idea here is if we can get grants to cover the expenses that are above and pay it out quarterly. So every quarter, each restaurant would get the amount of these expenses. And, of course, they'd have to submit receipts to show that they actually spent on these different categories. So we would get quarterly grants until we're able to take the training wheels off and get back open to 100%. That might be 4 months. It might be 6. It might be 8. We just don't know. But I think looking at it in general, we're going to need this help for about a year. So the ask that we're prepared to request from this committee is $360 million plus $400 million to at least cover property taxes coming in June. Because I would bet my bottom dollar that three-quarters of the businesses in this state, restaurants I should say, won't be able to pay their property taxes. They just won't. So that's the idea. And I think, as Mike mentioned at the beginning, the whole idea behind this is keep us propped up, keep us in business so that come July, maybe even sooner, I don't know, but we'll be able to get back to business and start raising that continued meals and rental tax that the state desperately needs. And that's it, and I'm happy to take questions.
First question comes from Representative Erin Hennessy.
Thank you. My hand was raised because I had still not received the documents, but they came through. I think it was just the size of all the attachments. So I don't have a question at this time. Thank you for your presentation.
Thank you. Mike Summers, do you have a question or comment you'd like to make?
No, that was earlier. I was trying to respond about the documents. But can we turn it over to Steve Dupree?
Certainly.
Thank
Mr.
you.
Dupree? Please hit 5-star, Mr. Dupree. Yeah, we can hear you, Steve. Thank you.
All right, thank you. I'm sorry. I'm Steve Dupree. I'm in my office alone. I'm the owner of the Dupree Companies. I think you're all familiar with Concord. I think you know I own hotels in the city. I have 5 hotels in the Grapponi Conference Center, and I think the impact that I've experienced is common to every hotel and motel owner in the state. In a word, the industry has been devastated, and according to the most recent estimates from a consensus of industry experts, we're looking at a 5 to 8 year recovery. Just to let you know, in Concord, we went from a seasonal average in the time period of March 10th to April 10th, so it's not the high season that a lot of New Hampshire experienced. We went from 60% to 10% occupancy overnight. 100% of all conferences and events booked at the Grapponi Conference Center have canceled or postponed, with 80% outright cancellation. Cancellations now for September and October are continuing, and frankly, we don't even expect to be able to open the conference center until January of 2021. That represents a loss in that one operating unit of $3 million of revenue for the balance of this year, and an operating loss of $600,000 for me in that one facility. We closed the Courtyard by Marriott, the Fairfield Inn by Marriott, and we never opened the brand new and ready to open Hilton True. The Centennial Inn in this market, the Hampton Inn, and the Holiday Inn are all closed. The only properties open are the Best Western, which is helping with some special needs housing, the Hotel Concord, and our Comfort Inn and Residence Inn, which are available for first responders and incoming federal contractors. With that, we're running about a 15% occupancy. Our monthly loss from all our properties, even after closing two hotels and getting rid of every expense and furloughing over two-thirds of our staff, not opening one hotel that's ready to open, and closing the conference center, our loss and burn rate is $250,000 per month. And for the balance of this year alone, it's $2.7 million. I think Concord's a good bellwether market because we're neither seasonal nor tourist-oriented. But we're essentially a business traveler hotel with some leisure and an occasional event-driven weekend like the NASCAR race. The impact in the tourist market, like my home originally in Mount Washington Valley, could either be worse or perhaps slightly better this year if people do decide to travel. However, nobody in the industry expects a return to profitability for hotels until a vaccine is developed and widely deployed, which is probably late 2021 at best. Given that, it will be extremely difficult for many hotels to survive absent some program. I think my situation is fairly typical. I have loans equal to about 70% of the value of my properties, which is considered not high leverage given the extremely high capital costs of building a hotel, which frankly are even larger than those of restaurants. And I don't know whether my exhibit made it over to you, but if not, it will. The Federal Paycheck Protection Program does not work for hotels. May work for restaurants. I think it does a tremendous job for other businesses. It's essentially worthless for hotels right now. We've had to furlough, as I noted, over 75% of our workforce. Many of these workers are at wages from $13 to $20 per hour, and they make more at home collecting unemployment, as you'll see in the worksheet. If that got to you, if it didn't, you'll see it later. On the downside, if they return to work, they take a pay cut, they potentially expose themselves and their families to the virus, and they have to find childcare and or teaching if they have children. And, by the way, there's nothing for them to do. We've closed hotels. Technically, if we called an employee back to work and they refused to come, that could be considered a voluntary quit and therefore theoretically not eligible for unemployment, but that is not a valid reason to deny unemployment benefits in this virus era. Even if we call them back, let them stay home and collect full pay and benefits, there is virtually no chance that at the end of the Paycheck Protection Program on June 30th, there'll be any work for them then. We tried to convince Congress to allow a change of rule for restaurants and hotels to start the 8-week period August 1st, and Senator Shaheen fought valiantly for that, and I thank her. It would have cost the government no more money and been good for the employees and for us employers, but it was not included in the legislation. The results of the two other federal programs are yet to be seen, but I don't think they're going to work for the hotel industry. The first is the SBA Economic Injury and Disaster Loan Program, and the bottom line is the SBA simply doesn't have the horsepower to make enough loans fast enough to save the industry and doesn't have nearly enough money, even though there was $60 billion added to the new law that's going through Congress today. Those loans are at rates of 3.75% fixed for 30 years, and they could be useful if they were available soon enough in sufficient amounts to give a lifeline to some of the hotels until travel restarts. The Federal Reserve Bank Main Street Loan Program, with the final rules due late this week, could be helpful, but the loan parameters are very tight, four-year loans at market rate, and they won't be long enough for most hotels in New Hampshire, given that short term, to be able to pay them back. So the bottom line is that without a program that offers some favorable terms and rates, a lot of hotels in New Hampshire will disappear. I know there are lots of industries making a good case, but I would argue, other than an airline, there's no one who's been as hard hit as the hotel. You know, there are two different things you could do. You could, I've actually thought of three, too, in the testimony. You could come up with a loan or loan forgiveness program like the PPP, but with better parameters and controls to make sure small New Hampshire-based companies get it. Alternatively, you could do something like the EIDL loans, but not as long a term, say 5 to 10 years at below market rates administered by New Hampshire headquartered bank. The beauty of that would be it would leverage lending expertise of banks, and the loans could be recycled. I do have one final suggestion, no matter what you do. Any loan or grant or forgivable loan program you establish should only be available to companies headquartered in New Hampshire with a majority of ownership held by New Hampshire citizens. Why? New Hampshire's received this money from the federal government. Every state has received similar monies to help the businesses headquartered in their state. New Hampshire needs to give priority to true New Hampshire-based companies. Why? I'll use this example. Why should a real estate investment trust headquartered in, say, New York or Chicago, but with no local ownership, have access to these precious funds instead of them being required to access the funds available to them in their home state? They should not. Beyond that, publicly traded companies that own hotels have access to other sources of capital, but the small business owners in New Hampshire do not. I enjoy, for example, an Olive Garden restaurant owned by Darden Restaurant. But why should they have the same access as a national company to capital that great New Hampshire restaurants would have to fight with them to obtain? So we differentiate pricing on fishing licenses, hunting licenses, and everything else, but it would be a poor result if you put money into the hotel and restaurant industry in New Hampshire and it goes to businesses not headquartered here. That ends my formal testimony, but I will tell you two brief things that I would do. Number one, I would echo what Mike said. I think coming out of this, the quickest way to get the BPT up where the state needs it to get is to spend a substantial amount of money. And I'm talking on the neighborhood of $40 to $50 million, which is half what a United States Senate campaign costs in New Hampshire, and do a three-year, four-year national advertising campaign to get people to come to New Hampshire where we have wide open spaces and lots of room to socially distance. The other thing I would suggest is, and I will send you a separate sheet on this because I was thinking about it this morning, and those of you who know me know that every day I have a handful of ideas and only one of them's got any sense to it. But if the state were to take a pool of money of about $200 million, make term loans of 7 years at 0.5% with no payments in the first year, the state would get almost $40 million paid back a year, which you could then give as outright grants, say, to arts and other organizations, which are suffering too. But that money at, let's say, an average restaurant, small restaurant in New Hampshire needed $200,000, and a hotel you had a limit of $500,000. For $200 million, you'd recycle that money. You'd give us a program that works because the paycheck protection is worthless to us, and it would give that intermediate term that neither the federal Main Street lending program nor the theoretical but not appearing EIDL loan program would get, and that would probably give us the bridge. I will send you information about that last idea because it wasn't in my testimony. I'd be glad to answer any questions.
We have requests for questions from Senator Lou D'Alessandro.
Thank you, Jerry. Steve, in both cases, the restaurant and the hotels, you're looking for a serious amount of money to bridge. But what would you contemplate as a schedule for reopening in order, A, to take advantage of this money that you'd like to see come forward? And what's your chart say? What's going to happen in terms of recovery? Like 10% each month, 20, 30, 40, or how long does it take to get back to where you want to be?
I will echo what Tom said. You really can't open a hotel and say you can only limit 50% occupancy. I would strongly urge the state to not open at all, even though this hurts like hell. it's better, in my opinion, to keep the restrictions on enough so that we don't open the doors and then have it resurface again, because I think if we get wary travelers to go out to eat or to come vacation in New Hampshire and we see a serious spike, I think people will go underground and stay there until they get a vaccination. So here's what we've assumed. We have assumed we are not opening any closed facility until September 1st. There is not going to be a summer tourism season, and I just don't think of any level that will justify being open. I hope I'm wrong, but that's not what anybody is predicting in the forward planning that we're getting from Marriott, Hilton, and Choice Hotels. Then we're assuming that from September 1st until December 31st, we will get 35% of the business that we normally would have in that period. And then the assumption from January 1st, 2021 to June 30th, 2021 is that we would operate at between 40 and 50% of the business we would normally see then. And then our thinking is that after July, or starting July 1st, 2021, we should be at 50% of what we would normally have for business. And while we cannot make money, we probably can manage cleanly enough that we can hang on.
For the point, Mr. Chairman, Steve, given that situation, what would the dollar amount be needed for the marketing that has to be done by the state, and the dollars that are required to keep you guys fluid? Until that period of time expires.
Here's what I did in my thinking, because obviously we're going to access every program we can. We're talking to existing lenders to see if we can add lines of credit and things like that. But let's assume that there were 500 hotel restaurant loans, and this wouldn't help larger operators like Tom, although it could be per unit, at an average of $200,000. And frankly, any program you do, I hope, will start at the bottom and work up. The little bakery that does $50,000 a year that is husband or husband and wives, partners living. Let's start at the bottom with these. But let's assume you had 500 loans at $200,000. That's $100 million. And let's say you had 300 New Hampshire hotel loans at $500,000. That's another $150. That's a total of $250 million. And I think the term that's going to be needed is somewhere between 5 and 8 years. So let's say you had a 7-year term loan. You didn't make anybody pay. They could not make any payment the first year, so it's really a 6-year amortizing loan at 0.5% interest. The state would annually take in about $42 million in payments back. Let's assume 25% of those owners go out of business and the state doesn't get that. You're getting at least $30 million back a year. And over 7 years, of course, you get all the money back. And imagine if you were getting $30 to $40 million back a year. You could give those, at that point, that recycle money out as grants to not-for-profits to get them going. And I think you could get New Hampshire banks for a set fee. This is Jerry's expertise, not mine. But you could get you could make a deal with 4 or 5 New Hampshire banks to do the underwriting for you and do the servicing, because, frankly, they did a terrific job with very limited guidance and very confusing rules to get the PPP money out the door as quickly as they did.
Well, again, the numbers are striking, to be honest with you, obviously, and getting you people back in business is vital for the state of New Hampshire. No question about that. So I'm based on what you're saying, Steve, I'm thinking of a corpus of maybe $300 million to get this whole thing going. Is that the ballpark figure that you're playing with?
Steve, are you still with us? Hit 5-star, please, Steve.
Well, maybe he's disconnected, but Chairman Little, it just seems to me that based on what we've heard from these two groups at this point in time, we're looking at close to $500 million of recovery funds that could be moved in this direction to keep these babies alive. And we had a conversation offline when I talked about the loans and the fact that the little guys have not been able to acquire these loans.
I heard you.
Yeah, Steve, this would mean a strong emphasis on the loan program that's being offered by the feds so that the little guy, the small business person, could access those loans at a favorable interest rate, and that your program, the program that you're talking about, sits on top of that, and, yes, and as a result of that, makes the chances of recovery stronger because of the commitment.
Yes, it would have to be, obviously, subordinated debt, because if some people don't get the PPP, or they get the PPP and it runs out before business comes back, you're going to need this, and it's going to have to be subordinated debt, which makes it more risky. That's why I assume if you let out $250 million, $300, $400 million at 0.5%, you might see a 25 or 30% loan loss, because some businesses just won't be able to make it and get – this won't be all the money they need, and frankly, it wouldn't be all the money I need. I think it's, you know, my losses by the time we get back to break even will be between $4 and $5 million. It would help, but if it's the subordinate debt, at least it gets that money out, and I think we could design a program that works really well and gets that money recycled.
Our next question is from Representative Erin Hennessy.
Thank you. My question was around the debt structure, and you had just mentioned the subordinate debt of it. And I think that's a great option, given that a lot of these organizations are very small, but I imagine most of them already have debt, and some of them haven't been able to take advantage of things because of the debt requirements that they currently have. So I think that's a great idea. Thank you.
You're welcome.
We have a question from Senator Chuck Morse, please.
Thank you, Jerry. Steve, I don't know if this is to you or to Mike or Tom, but the reality of us knowing what we can do with this money yet isn't here. We haven't got any federal guidance that I know of. But having said that, I would think some organization, and I'm looking to you guys to suggest what it is, and I don't really think that the typical banking organization would work, because if we pick four banks and four banks already have clients, we've already seen what happened with the payroll protection with that. So what organization would you suggest? Is it BFA in New Hampshire? Someone?
Yeah, Steve Dupre, I'll take a stab at that. For purposes of disclosure, I'll tell you I am the vice chairman of the BFA. It's the little organization that does. It would take some scaling up, obviously, in a hurry. But the team they have there, I think, is exceptional and does great work. And I think they could run it. They probably would bring in some consultants from the banking world here. But I think the BFA could do this pretty handily. It would take some staffing up, but I think they could do it.
I just want to point out that they're speaking at 2:30 on Friday. You know, they need to speak to it exactly how they see it could work. I mean, the amount of money you're talking about, you know, with all the requests we're getting, I just can't see how we could do that kind of money. So what we need is to do multiples. We need some agency to team up with that, you know, we could write the forgivable debt and someone else could finance the debt. If we can even do that with this money, which I'm not sure we can, but in any case, I would think you need to start looking at it that way. And we're going to hear from you on Friday So,
will forewarn. I'll forewarn James P. Wallace that I've got a big assignment for him.
Thank you.
Very good. That is it for questions on that presentation. On that speaker. I think, Mike, you have one more speaker to go.
Yes. Can you still hear me?
Yes, we can.
Yeah, so Sim Willie, Hart's Turkey Farm, he's going to talk briefly about his single-unit operation, smaller operator, and then talk a little bit about the catering and function business. Sim, are you on?
I'm on. Can you hear me?
Yes.
You can hear me?
Yes.
Great. Yes, we can.
It's great. good afternoon, everyone. I'm Sim Willie. I'm located at Hart's Turkey Farm in Meredith in my office, and I'm by myself. I'm just going to start with a brief history of me and a little bit of Hart's. I'm a third-generation owner and operator of Hart's Turkey Farm restaurant in Meredith. I started picking up the trash in the parking lots for my grandfather during my summer vacations when I was 7 years old. I worked my way through the business, learning all areas of the restaurant. We are currently in our 66th year, and I've now brought my son, the fourth generation, to learn the operation. Hart's is a single operating unit centrally located in the Lakes region of New Hampshire. Along with loyal local customers, the tourist industry is what Hart's thrives on. To have a stay-at-home order has been devastating to us and our entire industry. Make no mistake, I understand the safety and importance of the stay-at-home order, but the reality of this situation is that it still is destroying our business. 2020 started out being very promising. We were looking forward to a great profitable year. In the first 2 months of the year, our business was up 16%. On March 16th, when the order came out, our entire industry was turned upside down. When this began, we had absolutely no idea what we were transitioning into, what steps we would now be taking, or how long it would last. We are now in our fifth week and are still trying to find the light at the end of the tunnel. We did throw away thousands of dollars in produce, meat, foods, wines, kegs of beer, etc., that were not returnable and were all going bad. On March 16th, I staffed about 100 full-time employees. By March 17th, I had laid everyone off, and I am currently running a takeout operation with a team of 8. April should be when we start gearing up for the busy summer season. We should be hiring, training approximately 100 more employees. Even with the influx of new workers, we should also hire approximately 20 H-2B workers and 15 J-1 visa workers to help cover the shifts needed in the busy summer season. As a result of the stay-at-home order and moving to a takeout-only operation, March 2020 ended with a 46% decrease in sales, where we were still open for half the month. We are expecting April sales to be down 59% and currently estimating May sales to be down 78%, and June I estimate being down by 88%. These summer months are filled with events that we would normally see an increase in general tourist population. We've already experienced a loss of Eastern approximately 50 catered events, ranging from small groups to large weddings. Looking through June, events like Mother's Day, Bike Week, I do the dinner train on the Hobo Railroad, and other larger catered events, weddings, will all become losses. For example, Bike Week will account for about a $350,000 loss to Hart's just for the 10-day period. The summer season is where most of our profitability revenue comes in, as evident by increasing loss in percentages each month. If the shutdown runs through June, we are estimating a total loss of revenue for the a la carte restaurant side about $800,000, and on the catering side, it will probably be around $825,000. Our fixed expenses have not changed. Things like insurance, mortgage payments, interest, utilities, property taxes, all these things I need to keep up with. The difference is there's no longer have a strong source of revenue. With this being said, looking to the future, we need funding. Our savings is gone. How many more loans can we take on to keep afloat? I still need funding to cover current expenses like utilities, payroll, food restocking, produce, taxes. Opening to a full dining operation, restoring our catering business is the goal, but there is no scenario where we simply open back at 100%. The face of our industry is going to change. This is going to take time, probably a full year, before we really know where we stand. Again, we need funding in the meantime, so our 66 years of family and tradition are not lost. Does anyone have any questions at this time for me?
Thank you very much for that presentation. We don't see any questions at this point, and we're quite a bit over your agenda time limit. So thank you all from the Lodging Restaurant Association. At this point in time, I'd like to move forward to the New Hampshire Retail Association. Nancy Kyle, are you on the line?
I am. Can you hear me?
We can hear you. Go right ahead.
Oh, very good. Okay. My name is Nancy Kyle, and I'm the president and CEO of the New Hampshire Retail Association. I'm talking to you from my home, and I'm here alone. For those of you that aren't familiar with us, we were founded in 1966. Our mission is to advocate for, promote, and support New Hampshire retailers, and 95% of our members are New Hampshire-based independent businesses. And I thank you for the opportunity to present to this advisory committee. It's been a nightmare for retailers. As America enters a second month in hibernation, the crushing effects of the COVID-19 pandemic on retailing are becoming dramatically apparent. For retailers that do not sell groceries and household goods, sales have dried up not so much overnight as within hours. For those without much in the way of online operations, sales have vanished altogether. And for those that were already struggling, including some of the larger, well-known names, the future looks especially bleak. In March, America's total retail sales fell by 8.7% from the previous month. This is the biggest decrease in the three decades the government has been recording them. But the worst is yet to come. Most states didn't shut their non-essential businesses until the second or half of March. April is shaping up to be a solid month of closures and job losses. It will be devastating. The stories of New Hampshire's independent businesses are so much worse and heart-wrenching than those national figures. A huge thank you to the state and Governor Sununu for allowing non-essential stores to do curbside pickup and delivery. This is letting some businesses at least have a trickle of sales, and it's something that a lot of states do not have. Curbside isn't allowed in Vermont, Mass, Rhode Island, New York, New Jersey. Just Connecticut and New Hampshire started with it, and Maine just added it. The numbers are staggering for both essential and non-essential businesses in New Hampshire. Retail stores have seen their sales fall anywhere from 60% to 100%. And rather than having people on the call with me, I have comments throughout my report from our members all over the state. This from Jan Desmond at Kilwins in Portsmouth. I'm an essential business because I have food, and my business has fallen 60%. But that number will rise quickly as I'm coming into my busy season, and each day is getting worse and worse. And from Donna Goodrich at Top Furniture in Gorham, we're a furniture store that sells appliances, so we are essential and open. The only business we're doing is appliances, and that's only 24% of our overall business, so it's very difficult. Sales are down 80%. Many retailers have seen their business fall off so much that they have just totally closed. Even with offering online sales, curbside pickup and delivery, their business has fallen off up to 90%, or their suppliers have closed and they can't even get product. The wise choice in some cases has been to totally close rather than to risk their employees' health. Many retailers are season-specific, carrying items for specific seasons that have been ordered months in advance. This is especially true of clothing and apparel stores. They won't be able to sell their spring merchandise as their stores are closed and sales are so low, so they'll have no money to buy the next season's inventory. Although employees are trying to keep their staffs on, it is impossible for many of them. Layoffs have been 70 to 100%. Many family-owned businesses are staying afloat with family members doing the staffing and not taking any pay, or they've cut hours for employees to keep them on, and owners are taking salary cuts. This is from Jude Dutil and Dutil Jewelers in Lebanon. Everyone is on full pay now as 75% of the Payroll Protection Program loan has to be used for payroll in order to be forgiven. I would have more flexibility if the window to use the money for payroll was 12 to 16 weeks. After the 8 weeks, I may have to furlough some employees. We've heard from our members who are concerned that the CARES Act unemployment benefit of $600 a week is a disincentive to get people back to work or to take a paycheck. Granted, it's only for 8 weeks, but it's still raising real concerns with our members. For example, an employer lays off their employees because the business is closed or they're open and sales have fallen so much. The employee is receiving unemployment benefits of around 60% of their normal pay. This amount, which amounts to approximately $360 a week for a $15 an hour person on a 40-hour work week. On top of this, the CARES Act grants an additional $600 per week as an add-on to the unemployment benefit until July 31st. So the person making $15 an hour would receive their $360 a week, then they'll get another $600, boosting their total benefit to $960 a week, which equates to a wage rate of $24 an hour. Business owners have had employees ask them to not rehire them until that $600 extra per week is done. Many retailers have applied for stimulus programs such as the Payroll Protection Program or an Economic Injury Disaster Loan through the Small Business Administration. Some members even have advisors through SBA and SBDC to help them with the application process. It was very challenging. Applicants were frustrated because there was no back button to recheck information, and there was no way to save or print the application other than to take screenshots along the way. We realized that this was all done really quickly to get money out as soon as possible, but the banks were unprepared and the process changed from day to day. Although some retailers have gotten PPP loans, many more have not, and they just haven't heard anything back. These comments were really prevalent when I surveyed my members. I filled out the EIDL loan questionnaire over 3 weeks ago, and all we received was a confirmation that they received the application. Nothing else has come of this process, nor have I received any funds. I applied for both PPP and EIDL, haven't heard anything. I applied for the PPP, it's been 10 days, and there's no word yet. And from specific members, I have from Rob Nadler, Ragged Mountain Equipment in Intervale. We tried to apply for all that was available through the SBA, but because we went through a C-11 bankruptcy several years ago, we were not eligible for any of the SBA programs. So far, we haven't found anyone at SBA that can resolve the issue. I know they're very busy, but our entire business is at risk of closing after 35 years in business. And I didn't realize, but you cannot get any of these SBA loans if your business has a poor credit history. And just this morning, as the new round of PPP money came out, I got a note from David Lurie from Plymouth Furniture in Plymouth, and he said, it sent me this email this morning. I have some big concerns with all of the legalese that seems one-sided. This was his email to his banker, and he copied me on it. All this legalese that seems one-sided and a potential nightmare going forward. This has blown up into the bureaucratic red tape that most hardworking small businesses fear. There is no mention of the forgiveness after 8 weeks of this program loan to keep staff employed or brought back. If we take this money, hire people back to operate a business that's running below 40% of normal, and we pay our employees to do work that doesn't exist, or we don't get our payroll back to 2019 levels, then we are stuck with this oppressive ball and chain to our livelihood. Leases and property taxes are a real concern for retailers. Many retailers rent prime real estate in their markets with very high rents. Some landlords are deferring rent payments and tacking them on to the end of the lease, or offering 1 or 2 months of 50% rent payments. But this help isn't going to go on month after month. Landlords need their money also. Many retailers that own buildings are in no position to pay property taxes this year. Simon Property Group has already asked Salem, Manchester, and Merrimack to defer for a year paying nearly $6 million in property taxes due in July for their malls, which are all closed. They are also asking for a 40% reduction in assessed value of their properties. Simon is already suing the city of Nashua to reduce the assessed value of Pheasant Lane Mall. Just imagine the impact this will have on towns if they don't get these property tax dollars. In normal times, many retailers' shops are destinations, and they have a lot of impulse buying. Downtown businesses, be it Nashua or Portsmouth or Concord, they get a lot of foot traffic in their stores. Now with a stay-at-home order, no one is even walking by their businesses, never mind coming in to shop. Overhead expenses are causes for concern for retailers. With no money coming in, they can't pay their suppliers, they can't pay their utilities, insurance, workers' comp, or health insurance premiums. Some are making partial payments for utilities. They're using credit cards for their business expenses, but they don't really have any way to pay those debts off. We've heard time and time again that the health of our members' employees comes first. Retailers that remain open, either that are essential or that are non-essential and operating with a curbside and or delivery model, are and from the outset have been engaging in best practices. They are doing their part to stop the spread of COVID-19 by protecting both customers and employees while keeping employees working and their businesses viable. Best Buy and Gibson's Bookstore in Concord, they both closed their businesses and went to a curbside pickup model before the governor even mandated that. Many retailers have installed plexiglass shields at points of sale to protect employees and customers and created special hours for at-risk populations. Some are operating under reduced hours, closing earlier to provide additional time to replenish essential products and thoroughly clean and sanitize stores daily. Making hand sanitizer and disinfecting wipes available to customers and employees, and providing masks and gloves to employees are also common practices. Stores are limiting customers inside where applicable, have added overhead announcements, store signage, floor markers, badges, and customer and associate guidelines to emphasize the importance of social distancing. All of these things and practices add to the overhead costs of running a business, but this is our world now and we don't see it changing any time soon. Welcome to the new normal. Some retailers believe that even without specific guidance for reopening, they will operate in a manner that will keep their employees and customers safe. Although they want to be able to help, they want to be able to open their businesses. They realize that if New Hampshire opens up too early, they may have to close again if a second wave of the virus comes, and their businesses will not rebound if they have to close a second time. The first time reopening must work. Consumers must be able to shop and feel safe. You can't have a successful opening of the economy if consumers are afraid to shop, so there's going to have to be some kind of marketing behind that. What our New Hampshire retailers really need right now is that they need financial help. They will not survive this if they can't obtain financing to overcome what they are living through and facing. Grants and low-interest loans are all vital. Many feel that even if they open fairly soon, that it will take months and even years to recover if they can even recover at all. And from one of our members in Nashua, Saima Foose, PRG Rugs in Nashua, we're very concerned that we can't continue in business as money is running out. The SBA has been slow to respond to our request for the EIDL loan. I wish I knew the outcome of this as it keeps us up nights. Right now, it's critical that we get some help. We are an almost 70-year-old business in downtown Nashua. I hope the fourth generation will be able to survive this. The one lasting impact of the pandemic that all of us here can confidently predict is a change in consumer behavior. If you do something long enough, you change your behavior. For independent retailers who typically operated on a brick-and-mortar model only, the increased reliance on delivery is a cause for concern. Online sales have been increasing recently at a pace of about 14% per year without the pandemic. With the pandemic comes news stories of Amazon stock soaring, and other retailers who utilize a bricks-and-clicks model are viewed as positive investments in the near future. Where does that leave our local hardware or jewelry or bookstore? E-commerce is going to be the big winner in retail. Amazon has seen such a rapid rise in demand that its infrastructure has shown signs of buckling. Last month, it temporarily blocked third-party sellers from shipping non-essential products to its warehouses to allow it to process their new demand. Having taken on more than 100,000 new staff in the past month, last week Amazon said it was hiring a further 75,000. All of this suggests that the pandemic will change shoppers' habits in ways that are likely to be lasting. By the time America is open for business again, more consumers than ever will be comfortable shopping online for everything from clothes to food and more. Safety concerns may drive them to continue shopping from home long after shops have reopened, and it will be horrific for New Hampshire's local retailers. The New Hampshire Retail Association has members who utilize a bricks and clicks model. All our major retail members do, as well as many of our independents. Besides offering online sales, they've made the investment in physical stores and have employees here in New Hampshire. The real danger, however, comes from online-only retailers, which have a distinct advantage in not having the costs associated with physical locations. New Hampshire retailers, and we on their behalf, are not looking to state government for help with business models. What we do ask, however, is that government, particularly the legislature, keep in mind the increasing pressure that independents have in an economy both before, during, and after the COVID-19 pandemic that relies more and more on remote sales and delivery. We ask that the legislature not exacerbate the advantage that online-only retailers possess by adding costs to brick-and-mortar businesses, whether it be labor costs, mandates, or other kinds of regulations. This is a time for all New Hampshire citizens to shop local and help their neighbors. They really need money. They need grants. They need our help. And I thank you for this opportunity to talk to you and tell their story, and I'm happy to answer any questions.
Thank you very much, Nancy. And we did distribute your document. I assume it's the statement that we just heard from you.
Yes.
Uh-huh. Thank you. Are there questions for Ms. Kyle? We're not seeing any raising hands on the screen, so we'll assume there are none. Nancy, thank you very much, and thank you for your patience. Sorry we were late getting to you.
Oh, thank you.
And I'll do my apologies to Gary Abbott from New Hampshire General Contractors, Associate General Contractors, up front, Gary. So I know you're with us. Go right ahead, Gary.
All right. Thank you, Director Little. And I appreciate this opportunity to speak before the senators and House members on the committee. For the record, my name's Gary Abbott. I'm the Executive Vice President of the Associated General Contractors of New Hampshire. I represent commercial contractors of both building and highway construction, including subcontractors and suppliers who work in the state. I am working from home. I first want to thank the governor that made construction essential, an essential service. It's clear that over the last few weeks, we have had some issues, but not to the magnitude of some other industries. So what I would like to kind of break this into two parts for myself is, one, I think highway is much different than building, and I want to talk about the highway. And more of my issues are not, I would say, projected issues. I know the Department of Transportation, Commissioner Victoria Sheehan, has made a presentation before the group. I know that they're actively going for some, what I would call some money from Washington to help us with the Garvey bonds, the TIFIA bonds, the loss of revenue that we're going to have from the gas tax and the toll revenues. I have touched base with the Department of Safety, and I know we're running some 40 or 50% down on revenue. I think one of the issues for us is even though we're completing current contracts, we are having hiccups, and I guess I just want to make sure the committee understands those hiccups. We are okay with Massachusetts and Maine, but we do have some suppliers in Vermont that are not able to work under their conditions, and it has affected some of our bridge contracts. We have a major supplier in Vermont that supplies precast components for bridge contractors, and I know that one of those bridge contractors did not start on time, but has since been able to get delivery of the bridge components, so they were able to start. But we also have an issue with Vermont in the sense that some of the contractors in New Hampshire have employees that live in Vermont, and they are currently not allowed to travel between the states without going back to Vermont with a 14-day quarantine. So that has disrupted a few jobs in New Hampshire where the employees that are critical. We have a project that's over the Connecticut River, a bridge project, that really has affected that job and delayed it until Vermont changes its stay-at-home work order. So what this highlighted for us is construction is somewhat of a fragile industry in the sense that there's a lot of contracts and agreements whenever a bid is put in. And if we end up with a supplier or two that can't perform, it has the domino effect for the entire industry. And so it's not only a time delay, but it can be a financial impact on companies. Now, I know what I'm doing is looking further out at the concern that if these backlogs continue, if we don't end up with this recovery money that I know Commissioner Sheehan is working very, very hard on, but I'm looking for probably the first thing for your committee to look at is if that backstop doesn't work, that we protect the integrity of the highway fund. In particular, I think what a lot of people don't realize is 12% of the gasoline tax goes to municipalities, so their projects will be affected, not only state projects, and it will, in the long term, have ramifications that are going to end up in the future but are not current. So I think that's the first concern, but I do recognize that we're very fortunate that we are an essential service. On the building side, has seen, in talking to contractors on the building, it's clear that their business models, as you probably know, for the last 2 years, our biggest problem was finding enough workers. Contractors were pretty maxed out at what they could do. This has really, for most contractors out there, they've seen a decrease in their work, probably between 40 and 50% on the building side. And the future of whether new construction on the private side comes along is questionable. It's hard to predict. This coronavirus is a brand new thing. It's unlike any other downturn that we've had. In previous downturns, we've had stimulus packages that helped construction, and we've always recognized that construction can lead us out of a downturn as well. So on the building side, I think what I want to do is just plant the seed that one of the most important parts is what scares me the most is if foreclosures start to happen and the domino effect and the backstop for the banks. And I'm not the Bankers Association, but I just want to put in place that there's so much at stake here as this affects all businesses and even those that are essential. So I really want to leave you with those two items. If the federal funding backstop doesn't happen, that the committee look at filling some of those gaps. And be concerned that if one of the key components is, and a lot of people, each supplier, personnel on the job, companies have got loans on equipment, trucks, bulldozers. And so once this starts to head in the wrong direction, if it's not corrected quickly, it could have a major repercussion for each one of those businesses down the chain. So with that, I would answer any questions. And and I really appreciate the opportunity.
Thank you, Gary. Do we have any questions for Mr. Abbott and the Associated General Contractors? Seeing and hearing none. Again, Gary, thank you very, very much.
Thank you.
I believe Pete McNamara, you are on the line, and you're up next representing the New Hampshire Auto Dealers Association.
Thank you very much, Commissioner Little. I appreciate the group's time in letting me present. For the record, my name is Pete McNamara. I'm president of the New Hampshire Auto Dealers Association. We represent every motor vehicle business that sells or services vehicles in the state of New Hampshire, from franchise businesses that sell cars, trucks, snowmobiles, motorcycles, power sports, RVs, and farm and construction equipment dealers, but also small mom-and-pop stores that do body shops, that do just independent sales and independent repairs. So we represent multi-store franchises, down to multi-generational and first-time business owners. We represent about 24% of retail sales in the state of New Hampshire, about 14,400 some employees, and about 500 businesses. In the past 3 weeks, we've done a couple surveys of our members to see how they are doing right now and what does the future hold for them. So I'll send to the group. I've just finished typing this up. I'll send to the group my written information, but I'll quickly summarize it here. So about 90 to 100 shops responded to each one of the surveys, and it's about 40% of them are franchise, 60% were independent. So let's touch upon net revenues. Expected net revenues took a big hit in both surveys, but the picture seems to be slightly improving. For sales operation, 70% reported lower sales, 6% actually reported higher sales, and that's typical in the truck, heavy-duty truck realm, because those, particularly the service operations as well as sales operations, are still continuing. And about 16% reported that sales were about what they expected them to be. For franchise dealers, the picture is a little bit rosier versus independents. And then same with the service operations. From a sustainability, so how long could shops last if things continue the way they are in terms of both sales and service? In the first survey, perhaps reflecting our Yankee mentality, 82% of the businesses stated they could last anywhere from 1 to 4 months at the March revenue level. In the past few weeks, and we just finished up a survey yesterday or this morning, this forecast has improved with about 86% of the shops believing they can last between 1 and 4 months. And even more critically, 70% of respondents stated they can last 2 to 4 months at the current revenue levels. And so this has improved just in the past couple of weeks. Franchise dealers fall heavier into the 2 to 4 month category versus independent. But that's also a reflection of car manufacturers and truck manufacturers require that shops have 2 months cash burn available on hand in order to be and maintain keeping a franchise dealer. However, these numbers are still grim. So upwards of 30% of motor vehicle sales and service businesses can fail within the next 2 months, assuming that all things stay the same. And then further, depending on how quickly the economy returns after the stay-at-home order is lifted, the auto businesses face similar hurdles mentioned by the Merchants Association. You have rents, you have mortgages, you have taxes. All of these items are still notes that need to be paid. Employee headcount is the next part of the survey. And then hours worked, days open, hours open. So a slim majority reported reducing the number of hours open and also reducing the number of days that are open. Franchise dealers were a little bit more quick to reduce the number of hours and days and the number of employees. Paycheck Protection Program, the CARES Act. The NHRA held several PPP webinars, also has a sophisticated webpage dedicated to COVID-19 and programs like the PPP. Of 100 respondents to the survey, the one that we just finished up, 96% said that they had applied for the loan, with 88% of the respondents getting approval, and 63% of those respondents have already gotten the PPP money. The ones that didn't apply that were declined, the small percentage that got declined, indicated that they are going to apply for the next round of PPP monies, which sounds like are just about or it just got approved. So my read of the survey in the slight improvements is really, I think, tied to the PPP money, whereas franchise shops could live for 2 months just because they're required to have that cash on hand, now could double that amount of time that they could survive. It's not, you know, it's still bare survival in that circumstance. Sales numbers, U.S. estimates predict sales of new cars dropping by 26% nationally. So if you look back at the Great Recession, titling numbers, so cars actually titled in the state, so they were transferred either private sales or public sales. Titling numbers started dropping in 2008 and didn't stop dropping until 2012. And then it took 3 more years before the titling numbers exceeded the 2007 levels. So if you look compared to 2007 numbers, the following years during the Great Recession showed percentage declines of 5%, 13%, 17%. So looking forward to today, put in raw estimated numbers, we could see decline in the number of vehicles titled or sold in the state of New Hampshire between 20 to 50,000 less cars. And if title shows a similar decline in a downturn as a Great Recession, we probably won't see sales bounce back for 2 to 3 years. Let's talk ripples. Towns and cities, parts suppliers are all going to be impacted, as well other businesses that feed off of automotive businesses. Towns and cities are slightly insulated as the registration fee drops every 3 model years. It doesn't drop annually. And it's also based on MSRP, not the actual sales figures. So they're going to be slightly insulated, but there will be a drop in revenues, very similar to what happened in the Great Recession for those towns and cities. Companies that purchase or auto suppliers that sell items to motor vehicle retails and sellers and servicers are also going to feel an impact as well, just because of less repairs and less vehicles being sold. So finally, reverse ripple. So listening to Gary Abbott, Nancy Kyle, if roads and houses aren't being built, trucks and cars aren't going to be bought. Same with retail businesses. If they start failing, then vehicles aren't going to be purchased by these owners and employees of those customers.
COVID-19 adjustments.
So a strong majority of our shops have already taken proactive steps of having hand sanitizers widely available, social distancing, of course, wiping down of vehicles. They have seat covers, steering wheel covers, gear shift covers for customers. And then the biggest thing is really just as Nancy Kyle mentioned, going to retail, going to remote selling, is a lot of them do drop off and pick up or concierge style service of vehicles, and then remote drop box to avoid contacts with customers, and then online sales as much as possible that's allowed in New Hampshire. I want to echo what the Merchants Association said, concerns about not putting additional regulations on brick and mortar companies like auto businesses, because as much as we do online services and some remote deliveries, we're still a very brick and mortar dependent type of service. It's not like buying other items. You want to be able to kick the tires in a car. You want to be able to test drive those cars, in particular the used vehicles. So we need to be careful about that moving forward. In closing, I just want to recognize Governor for his leadership in this difficult time. There are a few easy decisions to make and many people to frustrate. And the NHADA and myself personally think he's done a fine job in balancing the state's public health with the economic health. Auto sales and service are very fortunate to be deemed essential. Yes, business is down, but we recognize the necessity of implementing the stay-at-home order and the likely need to continue such orders and eventually slowly open the state without doing it too suddenly and risking that second wave of infections. With that, I appreciate everybody's time. I hope this information has been helpful. We'd be happy to take any questions.
Thank you, Pete. Very interesting information. Are there questions for Mr. McNamara from the Auto Dealers Association? Okay. Seeing none, we'll go to our last planned speaker for the afternoon. Jim Roche is with the Business and Industry Association. Are you on the line, Jim?
Yes, I am, Commissioner.
Take it away.
Great. Commissioner Little and members of the Legislative Advisory Board to the Governor's Office for Emergency Relief and Recovery, thank you for giving the Business and Industry Association this opportunity. Just as a bit of background, my group, the BIA, wears two hats. We're both the statewide Chamber of Commerce. We're also the statewide Manufacturing Association. We represent 400 leading employers across the state in most economic sectors. And while we're very proud of our large members like Fidelity Investments, BAE Systems, Sig Sauer, et cetera, you might be surprised to learn that nearly 70% of our members have an annual payroll of $3 million or less. Collectively, our members employ 93,000 New Hampshire residents, or one in eight private workforce jobs. So with that as a bit of a background, and I did want to make one comment before I get into some of the responses to Commissioner Little's question to the BI, which are, how have BI members been affected by the coronavirus and thoughts on spending the federal stimulus dollars? The two groups that were recently formed, the stakeholder advisory group to Gopher and the governor's economic reopening task, have no representation from the manufacturing or technology sectors, and it's been our view for a long time that manufacturing by itself drives New Hampshire's economy in ways no other sector does. All sectors are important, but manufacturers export products. New dollars, new wealth is generated within the economy, and the ripple effect of manufacturing is larger than any other sector. And so we would just recommend that both of those groups, the stakeholder advisory group to Gopher and the governor's economic reopening task, add representation from manufacturing and technology, among other sectors. With regard to thoughts that are turning to reopening the state's economy, it's very clear that workplace health guidelines are needed for non-essential and essential businesses. Many employers, especially non-essential employers who are not operating, are confused and unsure about how to go about returning to normal or reopening. We were pleased, obviously, yesterday to see the governor's announcement about the formation of the Economic Reopening Task Force. And as I just noted, we hope to see additional representation from manufacturing and technology on that sector. And presumably that group will be addressing things exactly like this, guidelines for employers of all sizes and in all sectors, whether essential or non-essential. Another area of concern, of course, is that all employers and probably most especially non-essential small businesses that have been shuttered and hospitals are going to need help coming out of the COVID-19 economic shutdown. We all know the hospitals have hemorrhaged money as they shut down elective surgeries in preparation for the coronavirus caseload surge. Looks like the state is aware of that and doing its best to address that. Most other employers are struggling with reduced revenue or no income at all. So we think the state should consider using federal stimulus money to help employers source and cover the cost of safety and testing equipment, which will be incredibly important as we begin to reopen and get back to normal. These would include things like forehead thermometers, plexiglass shielding, gloves, masks, et cetera. Employers may need assistance with property tax payments or other fixed costs as well. And, of course, the hospitality industry will need aggressive promotional help once New Hampshire has returned to normal to rebuild its customer base. Another area of growing concern among employers is workplace liability related to COVID-19. I'm going to share an example that a member of mine from the Seacoast, a small manufacturer, shared, and this really gets at the heart of the concern, the growing concerns in this area, employer liability. He says, we have 29 employees in a small company. If one person gets tested positive for COVID-19, they probably interacted with most everyone in the company. So does everyone have to go home and quarantine? Then the business shuts down. 2 weeks later, you bring people back and someone else tests positive, even if they don't have symptoms. Then you must shut down again. It puts business owners in a terrible position. If we tell people they don't have to go home or tell them not to go home, we could be held liable. So we think it's important that state policymakers create a statutory immunity or, in other words, a legal safe harbor for businesses that act in good faith and follow federal and state health guidelines during the pandemic. Without it, some businesses will be deterred from reopening or slow to reopen, and others will be slow to return to pre-pandemic operations. So, in fact, as a side note, BIA is considering creating a business liability working group to provide advice and counsel to lawmakers on this issue. And just a few other items, business taxes, without question, business tax receipts and other important state tax revenues are falling as a result of the shrinking economy brought on by the pandemic through no fault of their own. Many businesses throughout the state have lost customers and revenue. Many are closing. To enact BPT and BET tax increases at this time, as current state law calls for, if state revenues are 6% below budgeted expectations, to do that would be extremely insensitive to the struggles of employers of all sizes and will adversely impact their ability to rehire employees at the very time rehiring is desperately needed. It would also be counterproductive to a quick economic recovery. Similarly, unemployment insurance taxes is an issue for employers. It's clear that massive increases in the ranks of unemployed due to the COVID-19 is having a dramatic negative effect on the state's unemployment insurance trust fund balance. Positive rated employers, those that have not caused a downturn in the trust fund, will see their unemployment taxes automatically increase as trust fund balance thresholds that trigger tax decreases are lost. Similar to our concerns over increasing business taxes, increasing unemployment insurance taxes is highly counterproductive in the current environment. State policies makers must find ways to mitigate these increases. Finally, Commissioner and members of the advisory board, we are in the process of completing a survey. It began last Saturday. It ends Friday. It goes to the primary contact that we have at our member companies. As of yesterday afternoon, we received responses from 25% of our membership. And so within those numbers, 11% of the respondents have shut down as a result of the stay-at-home order. 22% have reduced staff. And another 15% think it's likely that they will. 44% of our members have employees who either refuse or are unable to go to work. And I will tell you that I've heard from a number of employers that one of the issues there is the unemployment benefits are in many cases so generous that employees are making more in unemployment than they and staying at home than they were on the job. As a counterbalance to that, 13% have awarded some form of hazard pay or additional compensation as a way to encourage those that are staying at home through strong unemployment benefits will actually come back to work. And then finally, and perhaps most notable, is 82% of survey respondents so far have reported lost revenue. And as I noted earlier, only 11% of BI members that have responded to the survey said they've shut down as a result of stay-at-home orders, but 82% of all respondents said that they lost revenue. So obviously that includes the companies that are still essential and still operating. 42% of that number have reported losses of between 11 to 25%, and 13% have reported revenue losses of over 50%, 50%. So with that, Commissioner and members of the committee, I'm happy to answer any questions.
Are there questions from the committee for Mr. Roche from the Business and Industry Association? I'm not seeing or hearing any. Just a reminder that Senator Morse has asked us to hold on at the end of our agenda today, which we are at, to discuss further presentations. One last call for questions.
Commissioner, if I may, this is Jim Roach. I just want to, I had talked to your staff earlier, and you should all have a copy of the testimony that I just gave. So happy to respond later, too, if necessary.
Very good. Thank you, Jim. We did receive that, so thank you very much. And thank you for your comments, Jim.
Appreciate it. Thank you all. And good luck with your efforts. It is challenging, for sure. Thanks so much.
Thank you. Senator Morse, you had asked that we come back to you at the end of the agenda today to discuss future plans.
Yeah, and just an observation from today, to be honest with you, the businesses that have been deemed essential and stayed open, while they're not anywhere near where they thought they'd be, they didn't really ask for support. I didn't hear it from the construction industry, and besides the hospitals that we've already heard of, I didn't hear too much out of the BIA, but the I think that we have to pay attention to that. But in any case, I've had several memos that I would like to understand, and that was from the disabled community. So I'm not sure who should come speak, but Mary Jane maybe could help with figuring out who should be here. But I think they may need some help. I also received another memo that had four different categories. One was dentists, one was mental health, one was eye doctors, and the other was pharmacists. I'm not sure if any one group represents two or three of those, but we probably could fit them in on Monday. So that's what I have from people looking to hear from people. I'm not sure if any other member has anything else they want to add to that list.
Very good. I did receive myself a request from the Independent Pharmacies Senator. Is that the group that you're thinking about?
I believe that list came from Aaron.
Very good. Thank you. Representative Wallner, do you have a question or comment? Five star. Representative Wallner, if you're having a hard time getting on.
I'm sorry about that. I was just going to say that I particularly think for the disabilities community, we should hear from our area agencies and Granite State Independent List. And I know that they would, I know there are people there who would help put together a presentation. This morning I started to hear a lot of people asking a lot of questions about the long-term care stabilization program that the governor has put in place. And I wondered if we might be able to get some sort of a presentation about that, who the workers are who are going to be eligible for that, how that money will pass through to the employee. I had a number of people reach out to me in the last few days about those payments to workers.
Likewise, Representative Wallner, I have also received a number of letters from a variety of points. I think the common thread is non-Medicaid supported long-term care facilities. And the general request that I've received is to whether or not there could be another round of funds distributed to those non-Medicare receiving facilities to support payroll to their nursing staff. Did I state that properly?
Yes. I've received information from them. I've also received information requesting around the long-term care stabilization program from group homes and homes where people live in group settings, maybe because of disabilities. So I'd like to learn more about that long-term care stabilization program, if we could.
Very good. Senator Susie.
Yes, thank you. A couple things. First, regarding the issue that was just raised by Representative Wallner, I've also heard from folks in the public safety realm about patient transport and care of those that are in the long-term care facilities. I think it might be worthwhile to hear from those public safety entities.
Public safety, and you said public safety and transport, so AMR and municipalities,
yes,
and ambulance,
yep,
services, is that where we're going?
Mm-hmm. Mm-hmm. Yeah.
Sarah.
Very good.
That's the first. The second one is I've received several inquiries from people about how to find information about Gopher, and I'm on the website, and I was told that there wasn't an agenda for today's meeting. And looking at it, it appears that there was an agenda, but it's dated Monday, April 20th, that has the agenda for 3 days. So people going on the site looking for it, I guess, were unable to find an agenda for today or Friday.
I see. Yeah, I'm sorry. That's our mistake. I was trying to be efficient and put three agendas out at once. I see
people probably weren't prompted to look for something else. And also in that regard, the recordings for Gopher don't seem to be getting up that quickly. So if folks miss part of the discussion or want to go back, that information isn't there either.
I'm sorry, did you say
the
recordings are not getting up? Yeah, there is a technical issue in that because these are fairly long. They're not easily transferred, but we're aware of that, and we'll try to get them up sooner if we possibly can, and we will commit to you to labeling those agendas differently.
Great. I just think in the interest of transparency, as people are trying to find us and hear the important work we're doing, we want to make sure they can locate it. And
agree entirely.
So thank you. Appreciate
good
it.
Good points. Thank you. Thank you very much. Senator Morse, we have a request from you.
Yeah, well, a couple of things. We have several requests in now that one came up on our last meeting, one I sent to you,
from Mary Jane. The I just want to talk about employment and Department of Ed. Employment Security contacted me last night about our request. They're working on it. They just want us to be a little understanding of everything they're doing. They seem to be a little overwhelmed. So they just asked if we could have a little patience on their request. I have not heard from the Department of Ed. And then, obviously, there was a request in about healthcare applications under a different group of money. We've seen what's been approved. We were looking to see what the other applications might be. And I think just to add to that, in dollars and cents, we're looking to see what that might be, you know, what's not been approved already.
Those are both issues that the staff is working on. The first one, to get the responses to your request from each of the state departments. We did follow-ups this morning, and we got the same response that you did from Employment Security, that they're just asking for a little bit more time because they're really, really busy trying to get people enrolled for benefits. And on the other, we're still working to try to identify and quantify all of the sources of potential revenue, specifically for the hospitals, but also healthcare generally, and we have staff downstairs working on that project as well. We'll get the information to you as quickly as we can.
All right. And Jerry, just thinking forward, if we're going to actually do Monday where we're going to have some more of these hearings, I think the next Friday, not this Friday because we've already booked it, we need to start to have some kind of idea, you know, what we're going to say to the governor, because I think that money's here. There's probably some things that have a bigger priority right up front and other things that can take a month to go through this process. But the things that are, you know, rising to the top that are emergency related, I think we should probably come up with some kind of recommendations from this committee by the end of next week. So,
agreed.
Anyhow, just a thought. There are a few people that have contacted me about exploring, you know, things in different categories and that we've already had, but they want to go in more in-depth, kind of like committee work. I encourage that. I mean, just understand you can't do that in a quorum, and the which I would assume is four in this group, but I haven't seen the document on that. But I think we need to do some of that, and as we do, if there's things that committee members want to present back to all of us, I think that'll be important. So.
Perfect. And as a reminder, Senator Morris, you were elected by the committee to be their chairman, and the concept of the chairman relative to this committee is to be the collection point so that we're getting information and presenter suggestions from one direction instead of eight. It would be extremely helpful for us if the members of the committee would forward their requests to Senator Morse to send to us. Senator D'Alessandro, I believe I have you next on the list.
Thank you. Thank you, Jerry. Jerry, just a quickie. Under the Emergency Health Care System Relief Act, we got the first allocation of appropriations on the 17th of April. I wonder what's happened since then with regard to the rest of that $50 million account. I think we should get that because it plays right into Senator Morse's question about the hospitals and who's received what and where, what other sources of revenue are available. And the second thing is I think for the first time we heard legitimate requests for money out of two entities that are economic drivers for the state. And as Senator Morse pointed out, there will come a time when we have to make recommendations. And from the Restaurant and the Hospitality Association, we got definitive numbers as to what they perceive they would need in order to recover. I think that's the first time, with the exception of the hospitals, that we've heard that. That's a vital concern to me, as it is to I'm sure everybody on this committee. And there will come a time when we have to make those recommendations, and that might come sooner rather than later. So I think within the next week or so, we should begin to hone in on those requests and evaluate that presentation. I didn't get all of that material. I apologize, but it never got to me. So I hope that I will be able to get that. I'd like to look at those graphs and presentations, particularly from the restaurant industry. And Pete McNamara said we would get a printout of what he said, too. I think it's important because he gave us some important information about his industry. And with that, I asked about help for the small businesses. And what we had a conversation this morning, and what I would suggest is that chambers of commerce in towns or cities that have some kind of a component within the mayor's office for industrial development, et cetera, they may be the sources for these small business people who just are being shut out in this loan process. And again, from what I heard today, they need these loans the most. So I hope that we might get the word out to mayors and to chambers of commerce that they could be a wonderful resource for these small businesses that are applying for loans. So thank you very much. Appreciate that.
Thank you, Senator. There were a couple of things there. You inquired about the balance of the fund. The balance of the money was received yesterday. So all of the $1.25 billion is in the account.
I meant the $50 billion that the governor set aside where the emergency health care system relief, he gave an executive order and $50 million general fund set aside. They've pushed out about $12 million. What's happened to the rest of that money since the April 17th report?
Got it. Thank you.
Thank you. Sorry for the confusion.
No, that's my mistake. I'm sorry. So the question is about the $50 million healthcare fund. Got it. We'll get an answer.
Jerry, I just want to make sure, because you brought up going through me, which I guess I'm in the Lou D'Alessandro category on that one. But in any case, everyone on the committee did receive my email address and cell phone number, I'm assuming.
Yes. Would you like us to make sure that they receive it again, Senator?
Yes, because if it goes to my legislative one, it's not quick enough to get you before we meet again on Friday. So,
very good.
If it all could come to my personal one, it would be very helpful.
All right. We'll send that out. Let's see. We have questions lined up. Representative Walmer, please.
Yes, and I will. I have a couple of more areas that I'd like to have some information on that I will email to Senator Morris. But I'm wondering about the federal guidelines and the guidance that we're waiting on. When we get that guidance, are we going to have a session on going through the guidance and reviewing how these funds can be used?
So we are expecting to receive the guidance anytime between right now and the end of the day Friday. We've not received any additional hints as to when it might be coming in. The staff here at the Gopher office has had a conversation, and we are all aware that we're probably going to be spending the weekend reviewing that document to fully understand it before Monday gets here. I think it makes an awful lot of sense for us, for you, Legislative Advisory Committee to have a conversation at some point as to what the guidance says and what it can be used for. That was going through my mind quite a bit today as we were hearing presentations. Senator DeSalastandrum mentioned that the lodging and restaurant industry made a couple of specific dollar figure requests, one for $700 million and one for $300 million. That in itself would use most of the funds that we have. So we clearly have some very tough decisions ahead of us. I think many of them are going to be made by that guidance that's going to come out of Treasury that explains to us how we can use those funds. I am not entirely clear yet as to whether or not we can use them to create a loan program that would be paid out over the next four quarters. One of the things we do know from the CARES Act itself is that we have to spend all of this money by the end of December 2020. So there are some operational issues that might not match up very conveniently with some of the requests that we've received. And then there's a bit of a limitation in that we've got the request for about $1 billion already today from two segments of one industry, and we have $1.25 billion for the state. So did I answer your questions, Representative Wallner?
Yes, I think so. I just want to be sure that we will have guidance available to us and that we'll be have an opportunity to talk as a group about the guidance and understand exactly what these funds can be used for.
Certainly, absolutely. The answer is yes.
Thank you.
I guess the question would be, at what time do you want that? Right, we do have a number of folks that tentatively we were going to set up for presentations on Monday, but it sounds like we're going to be adding quite a few more, and if you would like us to try to be able to prepare, to present to you about our understanding of the guidance, Monday might be a little bit soon, but we can give it a shot. Alternatively, we could have some more presentations on Monday and then dedicate Wednesday to a briefing on the Treasury guidance.
Jerry, I'm giving you my opinion. I think the guidance is so important. I mean, I think we're certainly looking into that guidance alongside you, but I would think, you know, even if Monday had to be rearranged a little bit where we got some of the guidance, if you're planning on doing that this weekend, which it sounds like you are, I would think we could do some kind of presentation on Monday. And I'd like to put this out there. There's no reason we couldn't roll that over into Tuesday and listen in to the other group getting a presentation on it also. Because I think we all want to know what we can do and what we can't do. I'm assuming some of what we heard today can't be done, but that's, you know, it's a huge assumption. But I also like to point out, this is no different than the budget we build in the state of New Hampshire. We have to determine priorities, and it certainly is going to, you know, take some kind of magic to shoehorn all these requests into $1.2 billion, and I personally recommend that we don't spend it all right up front, because I think there'll be things that we don't know about shortly, you know. So in any case, I think it's important to hear what the guidance is going to be, because we're taking a lot of information in, and maybe some of it will not be used. And if I could just point out one other obvious thing, I think the people presenting have all done a great job, and I also think that we have to give them more guidance in what we're here for. We don't have any say, well, maybe some of the people on this call do, but we don't have say in opening up businesses in New Hampshire or anything, and we've certainly heard about that today because it's all business related. We're responsible for, you know, helping the governor decide where $1.2 billion should go, and we should try to get the conversations pinned in on that, because I do think it's going to get more and more complicated as we listen to more groups.
Understood. Representative Hinch.
Yes, thank you, Jerry. So actually, I was I agree with what Representative Wallner said and also what Senator Moore said. I was looking at my calendar, and I think that all of us right now should absolutely pencil in next Monday, Tuesday, Wednesday, and Friday. And I would say on Monday, assuming that we have the Treasury guidance, we could have a preliminary discussion on that and also fit in some of the groups that were suggested here today, but then really get into the meat of it on Tuesday, so that we get a very thorough understanding, because I think, as Chuck said, we may have had or may be scheduling people that the Treasury guidance won't allow us, unfortunately, to do something for, like they may request. So we need to know, you know, what the parameters of that are before we go too broad with more people, although I believe we should hear from more people. So if that makes any sense at all, I think we need to block out the calendar for next week, and I would say at a minimum Monday, Wednesday, Friday, and probably even go into Tuesday for a thorough discussion of the guidance.
Thank you, Representative Hinch. We have some basic structural issues here on this end, as there is also a stakeholders advisory group aboard, and they have their meetings scheduled for this same time on Tuesdays and Thursdays. So,
Monday, Wednesday, Friday.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday is doable on this end. Going into Tuesday will create scheduling conflicts between the two groups that were set up through the governor's executive order.
Mm-hmm. Okay.
We could, you know, an alternative is that we could invite the folks from the stakeholder advisory board to join you on Tuesday for the more in-depth, or you could join them on Tuesday for the more in-depth discussion of the guidance from Treasury, and I know that there are people in our other office who are cursing me right at this minute because they've already been building out their agenda for their Tuesday meeting. But we'll try to finesse it. We understand what your intent and your request is, and we'll do our best to honor it. How's that?
Okay, great. So we can at least firm up Monday, Wednesday, Friday then.
Monday, Wednesday, Friday, we will do. Perfect. Representative Hennessy?
I was just going to chime in. I think that once the guidance is available, that we should do a joint meeting. I listened into their meeting yesterday. They've got a lot of intelligent people on there, and I think both groups can benefit from any questions either of the groups might ask, and it also be a, I don't want to say a waste of time, but I think it would be more efficient for both groups just to hear the information at the same time and as soon as possible.
Very good. Thank you. Senator Morse, we have your hand up again. Do you have another question, sir?
No. That was from before, Jerry. Thank you.
Okay. Speaker Shurtleff? Question.
Yeah, just first of all, thank you, Jerry, for all that you've done. I just wondered, when we had the segment on mental health, if we could get somebody to speak about the impact on the homeless. And I thought possibly somebody from Harbor House in Nashua that's done so much for the homeless veterans, just to see if there's anything that needs to be done there. And the other thing, of course, I I thank my friend, Representative Hinch, for his suggestion, and I think all of us are available at any time at the call of the chair. So thank you.
Thank you very much, Mr. Speaker. We've had a lot of suggestions today, and so I think what I will probably do is try to put out a quick memo either this afternoon or tomorrow morning to list out the requests for future presentations, as well as inform you of the ones that I have received directly, and see if we can't group them conveniently in some way. We'll do our best to organize. We'll report to you on Monday our general understanding of what the guidance says, and then on Tuesday we'll try to organize something with the other committee, the Stakeholders Advisory Committee, to maybe go a little bit more in depth as to what we believe it says. And then for this committee, the Legislative Advisory Committee, we'll fit in some of those additional presentations on Monday, Wednesday, Friday next week. Did I say that? Is that what essentially you
sounds
asked
good.
Us to do? Sounds good?
Yep.
Any other questions or comments? All right. Thank you all.
Thanks,
once
sir.
Again, very, very much. You're being very generous with your time, and we are greatly appreciative of that. So thank you all.
Thank you, Jerry.
Goodbye.